Welcome to Invisible Church, the St. Paul's Bible Study Podcast. Today we're looking at Genesis chapter 35, a chapter filled with death and loss for Jacob, and yet a chapter in which God reminds his patriarch that he is with us always. We are in Genesis chapter 35. And this is an amazing chapter of what's happening in our book. I'm really happy to be with you here doing this tonight. And I'm looking forward also to the next one, which is kind of an odd one, 36, and the genealogy of Esau and the kings of Edom. But we're going to look at not just the text there, a list of names, but some of the other surrounding peoples around Israel and some of the history of what happened. At least that's my intention next week before we get to the juicy part when Joseph's going to be sold into slavery in chapter 37 and the beginning of that. This morning, we still get a newspaper at church here called Christian News. Some of you know what that is. And an article just this week, I was reading a piece about translating, and I just kind of was thumbing through it to find one thing, and I found a thing about translating, and I tried to scan it, and I had it wrong in the machine, so I got the article above it instead. And in the article above it, it was all this stuff about a woman who was attacked by a man, and he tried to rape me, and he left his coat on my bed. And I'm thinking, what is this? And I'm reading this, and then at the end of the article, she said, I don't want to leave my first name, but I'm going to sign it Potiphar's wife. And I thought, wow, that sounded contemporary. But it was just a retelling of the Potiphar's wife, Joseph and Potiphar's wife, in kind of the, it was obviously tongue-in-cheek, but it was pretty interesting. It really caught my attention anyway. Maybe more about that some other time, maybe not. But Genesis 35. Here Jacob returns to Bethel. And this is a chapter of loss, of death, of big changes in Jacob's life. God appears to Jacob to remind him that he's with him, just as he always is with each one of us. And I think we're just going to get right into the text. So God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel. And by the way, up in the Bible is almost never north. Up is up. Up the hill. That's just what it is. So go up to Bethel. And almost from anywhere in the Bible, even if you're geographically above it, up also is always to Jerusalem. So you never go down to Jerusalem, even if you're above it, looking straight down at it. You go up to Jerusalem, even by helicopter. So it's always up to Jerusalem. There aren't many helicopters in the Bible. But God says, go up to Bethel and settle there and build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. And as we're just in verse 1 here, Herb and Joanne, remember the context. Jacob's sons just committed mass murder. Jacob has just said, I've become a stench to all of our neighbors. And I wonder if he's wondering, has God forsaken me? God's answer is, no, I haven't forsaken you. I'm right here with you. Keep going. Keep going with what I told you to do. So as God has allowed these things to happen in Jacob's life, and this is from Luther, God allows the devil to have his little rampages to show that he set boundaries just as he has with the sea. Remember what God says about the sea in Job? This far and no farther. Yeah, God sets the boundaries. And so it was, Luther says, with Jesus in the garden, let them have their way for now. So let the devil think he has little victories. This will just give God more glory. I can polish my silver, but to really show it off, I put it in a dark place and throw a light on it. And then you will see how beautiful it is. So Jacob, you are safe. Your neighbors will not overwhelm you. By the way, the Renaissance painters did this with their paintings by using large areas in their paintings of white or black, which today an art critic would call negative space. So you have all kinds of darkness, and then some shadowy figures and a dog, and then the face of Moses or Mona Lisa or whatever it is. And it draws your attention to the thing. They understood this idea of God's glory in the darkness. That's part of what that's all about. So, but this also shows us why do we return to the Lord's Supper? Why do we go back to worship when our faith is weak? By the way, if my faith is weak, should I go to the Lord's Supper? Yes, that's what it's for. If I have doubts about my relationship with Jesus, should I go to the Lord's Supper? Yes, that's what it's for. If I haven't been to the Lord's Supper in 5 years, should I go to the Lord's Supper? Yes, 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 please do. I don't know if I've told you this story. Years ago, probably 12 or 15 years ago, we had a young man who got confirmed, and his grandmother, our member, said, "Don't go to communion your first time without me." But the day after his confirmation examination, she went into the nursing home. But he obeyed his grandmother. So he didn't go to communion, didn't go to communion, didn't go to communion. She died. And a couple years later, he came to me and said, "Pastor, what do I have to do to come to communion?" He had never gone. He was out of high school, and he had never gone. And I said, I almost said his name. I said, "Just come with me. What do you think I should have done?" I gave him communion right then and there. We walked upstairs. He came into my office. We walked upstairs. I got out. I took him in the sacristy. I poured out wine. I used the big chalice, actually. I got out a couple of wafers. I brought him down because at that time we were still doing communion in front of the altar, you know, at the step. I did the whole liturgy with him. Did the whole thing. It took like, I don't know, 6 minutes or whatever, but I did it. And then I said, "Now come back on Sunday." And he didn't, but he does come from time to time. But I use that as a warning to our kids. If grandma says, "Don't come without me," this is communion. You tell her, "Too bad, grandma, you come when it's convenient, but I'm going to communion." Don't wait for your grandmother. So if your grandchild says, "Too bad," to you, that's why. It's my fault. But come to the Lord's Supper. The Lord meets us in worship, and in the Lord's Supper especially, with his forgiveness, with every promise. This is why we come. He gives us assurance. He gives us strength. He gives us comfort. 25 years ago, was it, when Promise Keepers showed up around the country? Do you remember this? It was kind of popular in Reformed churches, Baptist churches and so forth, Methodist churches, and some Elka churches. Elka was brand new in those days. Promise Keepers was a men's, I think, organization where we're going to make promises, we're Christian men, we're going to keep them, but it was all about what I can do. And there wasn't an emphasis on what Christ has done for me. There was lip service to Christ, but I had relatives who got in this and who got frustrated with it and disappointed in it very fast, because it begins with Christ. It can't begin with me. So we go back to him in worship. So Jacob going to Bethel, you see him in the map here. Do I have the thing up? He's gone from Mahanaim to Peniel to Sukkoth. Now he's gone across the river. He's at Shechem, and that's where the arrow turns downward. And now he's going to Bethel. Ai will not get mentioned in our text, but he's on his way down to Mamre. You see Mamre at the bottom of the map? Can you read the word there? So he's on his way down there. On the way, he's going to go past Jerusalem. Doesn't come into our story either, but wow, Bethlehem does. Something's going to happen at Ephrath or Ephrathah. So, but he's at Shechem now. So verse 2. Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you, and purify yourselves and change your clothes. Then come, let us go up to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and who has been with me wherever I have gone. I have to admit that when I first read this, as I'm reading through the Bible and so forth, I always think, Jacob, you knew about these false gods. Why didn't you do anything about them? Would a father today or a husband say something if somebody in the household were reading the horoscope? And then I think, well, you know what? My dad didn't. Somebody in my family read the horoscope every day and said, oh, it's just for entertainment. Very clever of the editors to put the horoscope in the entertainment, on the funny pages, right? In the entertainment section by the crypto quote and everything in the crossword puzzle. But the horoscope. And I remember as a boy being really uncomfortable, you know, seeing her reading the horoscope and wanting to say something. I'll bet sometime I did. I was kind of a mouthy kid when it came to my faith. When my babysitter used to light up a cigarette, I'd blow out the match. I was that kid. That story got told at her funeral, at my babysitter's funeral. But if Jacob did know about it, now what does he do about it? Get rid of it all. In fact, he does four things. Let's take a look at him. My catechism class said I don't have enough blanks on my worksheets, so you have blanks on your worksheet. Get rid of the foreign gods. What does he say next? Did you catch it? He says, purify yourselves. What does that mean? Purify yourselves. If God told you to purify yourself and part of it was get rid of the foreign gods, what might you do next in an Old Testament culture? The gods are out. You've confessed that they're there. We're talking about ceremonial cleanness now. I think a bath is next. That's number two. I think that's still part of purify yourself. I think that purify yourself probably meant a ritual bath. Also because it's followed by this. Number three is change your clothes, that Jacob says. So probably that was involved in all of that. Purify yourselves. Maybe that's, if you only have one set, maybe that's wash your clothes. Let them air dry or whatever and then put them back on. And we're all sparkly clean. And now and only now, after, and there are no ceremonially clean laws yet, right? The Leviticus is 450 years away. There's no law about that. But Jacob says, let's do this. Get rid of the foreign gods. We're going to purify ourselves, which I think means take a bath, and then change your clothes, put on your best, and last, then come. Now we're going to go to church. So we're going to Bethel. I'm going to build an altar. We're going to have worship. And while we're at Bethel, what am I going to do? What would you do if you were Jacob? You were alone at Bethel once. Now your whole family is with you. What do you want to do when you get there? Jeff?
Say thank you to God.
Thank God, yeah. And for the kids, what else would you do? I would first of all thank God, and then I would tell them the story. This is where it happened. When I drive my family back to Poinet, Wisconsin, we go into town. One block away from the high school is a house, a square, an old-fashioned 19th century square house, 128 South Lincoln Street, with a big garage set back away from the street with a long driveway and a basketball hoop, with a backyard with peony bushes and a garden. And I tell them the stories. This is what happened there. Where the mailbox stands now, when I was a little boy, to my mother's horror, I accidentally planted a walnut tree and it grew huge fast. And I learned to read in that tree. And I spent summers climbing that tree and reading books. I read the entire Lord of the Rings in the branches of that book, of that tree, over the course of the summer of, I think, 1979 or 78, whatever it was. I played with my G.I. Joes in those peony bushes and got stung by the bees. My brother and I lost our football in the huge rhubarb patch. I played in my mother's garden as if it were the La Brea tar pits, and I were rescuing a woolly rhinoceros from sinking to death. My brother and I made snowmen football players as the defensive line, and we would try to get around them with our end game. We played two-man wiffle ball, and all the things we did. And we played catch by throwing a ball against the house until we broke the tiles, and Dad made us come out and fix them. And when we bought a pitch back finally, and there's the house my dad fell off of and landed feet first in the neighbor's yard. And my neighbor made him a little clay award with deep footprints called Best Double Gainer of the Year. And my dad survived that, you know, and all the things that happened at that house. Jacob would have taken them to Shechem, to Bethel rather, and said, this is what happened. This is where I saw the vision of the stairway to heaven. And this is where the Lord appeared to me, and where he promised me that the Savior's coming from this family. And look, imagine him looking at the boys. From one of you, you know, and all around them. So, verse 4. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods that they had, and the rings in their ears. Are earrings significant? Do they have a cultic significance? I don't know. But they gave them to Jacob. They gave them up. So maybe they did. I don't know. But he buried them. They all the foreign gods they had and the rings in their ears, and Jacob buried them under the oak at Shechem. Then they set out, and the terror of God fell on the towns all around them, so that no one pursued them. And I think this terror of God is more than just what Simeon and Levi did, because God talks about it many other places in the Bible. In the especially in the books of Moses, but also in the book of Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, this expression, the terror of the Lord, kind of disappears in Judges. You know, they weren't the best leaders in the book of Judges, but it comes back in Samuel. But there is this verse in Exodus: I will send my terror ahead of you, and throw into confusion every nation you encounter. I will make all your enemies turn their backs and run. And there are many other verses like that, where God would send his terror. This is more than just what happened with Dinah and the Shechemites. This is God making people scared of the Israelites. God, the hand of God. Jacob and all the people with him came to Luz, that is Bethel, in the land of Canaan. There he built an altar, and he called the place El Bethel, God in the house of God, or the God of the house of God, really. And he called, because it was there that God revealed himself to him when he was fleeing from his brother. So Jacob builds an altar. He gives the place a modified name, and if he gives it a new name, he's calling on the name of the Lord. He's preaching. So his sons are hearing him preach. Is it doing the sons much of any good? I think as the father is preaching, the boys are staring up at the sky, looking at the blue jays, checking out the trees. They don't act like it was sinking in. Later in life, maybe some of it would sink in. But when we were younger, when the pastor would preach, did our minds wander? Sometimes. I will tell you that at Zion Lutheran Church in Leeds, Wisconsin, if you're sitting back far enough and you put your head back on the pew and stare at the farthest fan forward, if you stare at it long enough, it looks like it's going backwards. And it's really cool. You just get mesmerized by that. Not that anybody who's at Leeds listening to this should try that now. And one time, my mom and dad went up for communion, and on the arms of our pews, there were decorative pieces of wood that I would call a rosette today. I was playing with one of those one day. I was pretending I was a spy breaking into a safe, turning it this way and that way, you know, and it came off. That was not a happy Sunday afternoon when Dad came back from communion and I've got a rosette in my hand and there's a big bolt sticking out of the end of the pew. Dad was not thrilled about that, but we had to go back to church. It's a 20-mile drive. We came back to church that afternoon, had to go to the parsonage, ask the pastor for the key, go back in and fix it. And I had things I wanted to do, but no, we're going to do this. We're going to fix this. And then he took me fishing. So, but verse 8. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oak outside Bethel. So it was named Alon Bakuth, the tears of, or rather, oak of weeping, Bakuth. That's the word for weep. So Bakuth is the weeping, the sobbing. Who's Rebekah? Do you remember? Rebekah is Jacob's mother. Mother. Jacob's father, Isaac, is 168 years old. Now, when Jacob was 40, he married Rebekah, and Rebekah was probably a teenager. So I'm going to say there's 20, 25 years in between them. So if Jacob is almost 175, Rebekah is pushing 150, 140 something. And do you think that the woman who was her nurse is older than she? I sure do. So I think Rebekah was probably Isaac's age. So Rebekah is in her 160s, 170s. Maybe she's 180. Time to retire, Rebekah, pretty soon. And old Rebekah, who's been traveling with them, dies. Wow. I wonder how respected this woman was, that they loved her. And I wonder if Rebekah was the one who was the midwife, or the trainer of the midwives for all of the children that all of Jacob's wives had. She's the old lady. She's there was a woman in the Civil War who was the head of all the nurses. I forgot her first name, but her last name was Dix. And they called her Mother Dix. Little, angry, ornery woman. And General Sherman said, well, she ranks me. But they called her Dragon Dix. She got her way. And I kind of wonder that about Deborah sometimes, if they called her Dragon Deborah or something like that. So Deborah dies. They bury her under an oak. And another Deborah is also known for another tree at Shechem. Deborah the judge. Her tree was what kind of tree? Not an oak. It was what you don't expect to be growing on a mountaintop. It was a palm tree. So in the book of Judges, all of a sudden you find out the palm of Deborah was at Shechem? Yeah, up there on the mountain, way up there where the pine trees grow, and there are a couple of oaks up there, there's a palm tree, and Deborah said, you find me there. That's where she sort of held court when she was a judge, the Judge Deborah. So two different women separated by about 500 years, 550 years, but Deborah the judge and Deborah the nurse of Rebekah. Verse 9. After Jacob returned from Padan Aram, God appeared to him again and blessed him. God said to him, your name is Jacob, but you will no longer be called Jacob. Your name will be Israel. So he named him Israel. Since it says after Jacob returned from Padan Aram, I kind of think this is not happening now, but this is a retelling of the story. In fact, what I think is that this is part of Jacob's sermon. I told you he would be telling the kids what happened to him. This is that retelling to the kids what happened to him. So not another separate incident. But Jacob said to him, or God said to him rather, I am God Almighty, El El Elyon, and be fruitful and increase in number. A nation and a community of nations will come from you, and kings will be among your descendants. I wonder if the boys were listening then. Because how many of Jacob's, I don't know the math myself. How many of Jacob's sons were the ancestors of kings? Well, we know of two for sure, right? Certainly Judah. But what other, who's the ancestor of King Saul? Everybody in the Bible named Saul is a descendant of the same tribe. Benjamin. Benjamin. So Paul is a Benjamite, and Saul, the king, is a Benjamite. There's another Saul too, a Benjamite. So all Benjamites. But some of the other guys, Ephraim gave us some kings. Manasseh, I think, because they're kings in the north. So I wonder, I haven't done that count. I should do that sometime. How many of Jacob's sons were the ancestors of kings? Because you have all those northern kings Zimri and Omri and so forth and all those guys. Bad King Ahab and Jezebel and so forth. Some of those are from Zebulun, I think. So for some reason, however, in all of this, I don't know why, if Jacob left it out, but there's no retelling of the messianic promise unless we count it as coming from kings will be among your descendants. But apart from that, there doesn't seem to be any retelling of the promise of the Savior.